Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 27th. The war in the Middle East is now 173 days old. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. It's high drama, folks. The Biden administration abstained on a vote at the UN that demanded a ceasefire in Gaza, but didn't condemn Hamas. The Israelis were furious and chose not to send a delegation that had been scheduled for consultations with the White House. Now Hamas has bailed on the hostage talks. It's all rather messy, to put it mildly. We'll try to unpack all of this here today on the FDD Morning Brief. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Jonathan Greenblatt. He's the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, an organization with a storied history of fighting anti-Semitism and other forms of hatred here in the United States and around the world. But before we turn to Jonathan, let's talk about that drama on Monday. First, we should acknowledge that the sky is not falling. The IDF was already waiting to enter the town of Rafah for several weeks because of White House fears of a humanitarian disaster. The IDF will have to wait a little longer. What's tougher to accept is that the Biden administration appears to be buckling. Pressures from within the Democratic Party, coupled with pressure from the international community, is just too much for Biden to bear, apparently. The optics are such that Israel appears abandoned. Whether that's true or not, Israel's enemies smell blood in the water. Let's also consider how this looks for the United States. It's sad to say, but gone are the days of skilled American diplomats wrangling over the nuances of resolution language. We flat out lost to China and Russia here, folks. America rolled over. So much for great power competition. Biden apparently believes that trying to end the Gaza war sooner rather than later could earn him more votes in November. I have my doubts, but voters will soon have their say. I wonder how history will view the president. I won't say this was his Chamberlain moment. That's probably not fair, but this was not a profile in courage. Israel has emerged bruised from this, for sure, but there's more to it. Every day that Israel waits to enter Rafah is another day that Hamas can prepare for battle. And now Biden has invited the demented association of craven anti-Semites at the UN to have their say on the timing too. But this thing is far from over. The Israelis have to play for time right now, and they must not lose their wits amidst this cringe-inducing chapter of the history of U.S.-Israel relations. Now for your headlines. Headline one. Hamas has pulled the plug on hostage talks in Qatar. Anyone surprised? After the drama at the United Nations on Monday, the terrorist group apparently didn't feel the need to keep the talks going. For those following at home, that's weeks of delicate diplomacy on the part of CIA Director Bill Burns down the commode. I can't help but note also that Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders paid a visit to Tehran yesterday. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh even took some smiling photo ops with Iran's foreign minister. This entire episode at the UN feels like a shot in the arm for the terrorist group that 5 months ago was widely condemned by the international community. Headline two, an Israeli man was killed by a Hezbollah missile strike this morning in Kiryat Shmona. The attack was a response to an Israeli strike that killed three Hezbollahis in what was described as a strike in the north, the northernmost strike, in fact, conducted by the Israeli Air Force. And that was in response to attacks on a winery in the north of Israel, as well as an airbase on the part of Hezbollah. The tit-for-tat strikes continue. Maybe the United States can come out with a Security Council resolution against Hezbollah. And maybe they could call upon Hezbollah to accept UN Security Council Resolution 1701, demanding that the group withdraw north of the Litani River. This would make a lot of sense because I continue to watch the North and I continue to assert that this could easily devolve into a catastrophic war. Israel has lost 8 civilians and 10 soldiers since this low-intensity battle with Hezbollah began. Hezbollah has lost somewhere around 250 of its fighters. And headline three, the Israeli Shin Bet foiled an Iranian plot to smuggle large amounts of advanced weapons into the West Bank. This was quite a haul. We're talking about mines, grenade launchers, C4 explosives, plastic explosives, RPGs, fragmentation bombs, you name it. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, is responsible for all of this. Unit 4000 of the IRGC, to be precise. It's clear that Iran is still trying to open up another front in the West Bank during Ramadan. We're about halfway through the month-long holiday, in case you're wondering. I'm personally counting down to what's known as Al-Quds Day. That's the Friday, the last Friday of Ramadan. This year, it falls on April 5th. It's a holiday invented by the Iranian regime to contest Israeli control of Jerusalem and Israel's existence in general. The IDF continues to operate nightly across the West Bank, making arrests and confiscating weapons, all with the goal of depriving Iran-backed actors the opportunity to light the West Bank on fire. Fingers crossed. Okay, now for our discussion with Jonathan Greenblatt. Jonathan is CEO of ADL, a watchdog group fighting anti-Semitism and other forms of hate here in the United States and abroad. We're thrilled that he's joined us live today for the FDD Morning Brief. Welcome, Jonathan Greenblatt.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
Well, it's great to have you here. Let's just start with kind of a softball for you. Let's talk about ADL's mission. People think that you and your colleagues are focused squarely on anti-Semitism in the United States and anti-Semitism alone. But the mission is a little wider than that, isn't it? I mean, at the same time, I would also venture to say that you've been really busy since the October 7 attacks of last year. So what does ADL do day to day?
Yeah, so ADL is the oldest anti-hate organization in America. It was founded in 1913 in the wake of the Leo Frank trial. Well-known episode in American history where a Jewish man, falsely accused of a crime, wrongly convicted, and ultimately seized from his jail cell and lynched by a mob because he was Jewish. And ADL was founded in that moment with a mission to, that we still use today. The mission statement, as they wrote, was to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment to all. So we have always had a kind of core purpose to protect the Jewish people, but to do so by fighting all forms of hate. So whether my predecessors were involved, as they were, in marching with Dr. King, in fighting for marriage equality, in engaging on immigration in the 1950s, we've always had this dual mission, Jonathan. But today, when we've seen anti-Semitism surge in ways that we've never previously known, and we do that because we, in the ADL, we protect the community by measuring attitudes, tracking incidents, monitoring extremists, training law enforcement. We also do a lot of advocacy. We litigate in the courts and sue the bad guys. We file amicus briefs. We lobby for legislation. And then finally, to change hearts and minds, we're very involved in education. One of the largest providers in America of anti-hate content in schools, reach millions of kids every year.
Sounds pretty busy. And speaking of busy, we do see a lot of hate speech online right now directed at Jewish supporters of Israel, for sure. And there's something more insidious, and this is something that I've been watching with trepidation, and that is the denial of the slaughter, rape, and dehumanization of Israelis on October 7th at the hands of Hamas. If you would, maybe just talk to us about some of the similarities and differences between other denial of violence. I'm thinking specifically about Holocaust denial, and now we have something that we're calling 10-7 denial.
Yeah, I think if you look at anti-Semitism, sometimes described as the oldest hatred, it is sort of a conspiracy theory about how the world works that posits Jews at the center of some malevolent plot or, you know, movement to harm Muslims, harm Christians, harm the world, whatever the case. And of that conspiracy theory, there are several longstanding kind of tropes, which are almost like the foundational myths that prop up this conspiracy. One of them is denial. So, for example, denial of Jewish suffering, like the Holocaust, like now 10-7, like other episodes in history. By the way, in the Muslim world, Jews lived as second-class citizens for centuries and centuries. And there is denial that they ever suffered, even though, you know, we all know that they suffered from riots and farhuds and, again, institutionalized discrimination. So denial is sort of a persistent attribute of anti-Jewish discrimination. And we're seeing it today. The same standards that are applied to other victims of sexual assault are not applied to Israeli women. The same standards that are applied when you look at other cases of sort of war and trauma are not applied to Israel. It's consistent and it's despicable, but I think it demonstrates the depth and depravity of anti-Semitism.
Well, I've got to say, just as in response to that, as we look at the international response to the 10/7 attacks and looking at Israel's just war in Gaza, the response against Israel right now and the ignoring of what Hamas did on that day, it seems like ancient history now. And I can't help but note that this broader response really fits the bill exactly what you've just described.
Yeah, it's almost predictable, Jonathan. Like, again, looking at other episodes where they blame the Jews for exaggerating our suffering, right? Or for contriving some kind of pain. So it's just not a surprise that the anti-Semitism that we've seen explode in the last almost six months, it started on 10/7. So while this was happening, we saw on our campuses, in public places, I don't want to call them protests because they're not. They're active anti-Jewish demonstrations. And again, they just exploded.
Well, let's talk about campus for a minute. In November, you and I testified at the House Ways and Means Committee about the rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses. You and I talked about different things on that day. But let me just ask you, five months later, what is the landscape looks like on campus? Is it better? Is it worse? And what do you think, and what do you and your colleagues think about what needs to be done to protect Jewish students or pro-Israel students on campus?
Good news, bad news. First, let's start with the good news. Since you and I saw one another on the Hill that day, the Department of Education has launched 50 Title VI investigations, two-thirds of which are focused on colleges and universities. For decades, the Department of Education did zero to deal with anti-Semitic complaints. Now the Office of Civil Rights is very focused on it. That's great. Since you and I met, we've seen this as Students for Justice in Palestine, the worst actor on these campuses, suspended in many places, which has been great. And since you and I talked, there has been a bright light shine on this issue in ways that are giving it attention it never had before, which is great. Here's the bad news. The bad news is that the issues are persistent, and in some cases, I would actually say getting worse, because the bad actors feel more emboldened because their leaders are not being expelled. They're rarely being suspended, and there are few consequences applied to them. So this past weekend at the University of Michigan, at the school-wide convocation that happened on Sunday, anti-Israel, pro-Hamas, activists penetrated it, disrupted it, and then what did the administration do? They just ended it. No one was suspended. No one was expelled. No one was taken out of the room. They literally ended the whole event. I mean, it's mind-bending. And by the way, a couple days earlier, the head of the SJP chapter at Michigan essentially made a death threat against quote-unquote Zionists, and no action was taken. Like, how can this be? Since I saw you, I've spoken to places like Brown, or Vanderbilt, or Texas Christian University, many other Wake Forest. And the level of anxiety among the Jewish students is real because the threats are real. The assaults, the vandalism, the harassment happening every single day. So what needs to happen first and foremost? Campus presidents and administrators need to lead rather than being led by the mob and enforce consequences on the kids who violate the codes of conduct. First and foremost, it needs to happen, right? Without that, nothing really matters. Secondly, we need new rules put in place. No, you shouldn't do ISIS cosplay on campus. Dress up like in a keffiyeh so no one can see your face and then assault people. If you mask on a campus, as far as I'm concerned, that should be forbidden. And then thirdly, I think we need time and place restrictions on protests. Again, I hate to legitimize these actions as protests, Jonathan. They're not. It's a campaign of intimidation against Jewish people. But that being said, if you want to take your little, ISIS pantomime, do it over there and let the rest of our kids and all kids study, go to the library, and live a normal life on campus without threat of being bullied, intimidated, or marginalized.
Sounds reasonable to me. You mentioned SJP, of course, that's Students for Justice in Palestine, and that is probably the most active group out there. And I think a lot of questions still linger about exactly how to deal with that group, which is not registered anywhere, and it's a difficult nut to crack.
Yeah, and look, they're the kind of head of the snake. But like this past weekend at Columbia, Samadoun, another terrible I'll characterize it as a pro-Hamas organization, was recruiting at Columbia University. And we've seen like PFLP flags show up at other places, Hezbollah flags show up on campuses. I mean, these are foreign terror organizations. You know, you can't do a bake sale for ISIS on the Quad, you get arrested. And you can't sell, you know, the Inspire magazine at the bookstore, you get arrested. Why there aren't consequences applied to these groups that are, and these individuals that are violating the criminal code, I don't understand.
Big sales for ISIS. Yeah. Okay. Look, I don't study this the way you do, but I've seen classical anti-Semitic themes emerge since 10/7 in ways that I had not seen before.
Yeah.
I'm seeing people invoke the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Mein Kampf and other just terrible tracts. It seems like old school anti-Semitism is making a comeback right now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, look. I mean, I think one of the things you've seen in recent years is this sort of silly, I don't think it's very serious, but it's become very serious. This sort of charade that anti-Zionism is some legitimate political kind of idea. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Plain and simple. But what we've seen is that what I'll call like our enemies, like determined detractors, like supporters of terror, are using anti-Zionism the way they can bring in other classic forms of anti-Semitism. So delegitimization. I mean, Jewish people have been delegitimized for 2,000 years. They delegitimize our religion. They delegitimize our quote unquote race. Now they delegitimize our state. Like it's part and parcel of the anti-Semites playbook. But again, under the guise of anti-Zionism, well, you can do that, right? Again, the denial of history or the denial of suffering, again, under the guise of anti-Semitism, you can do that. Myths about Jewish power, myths about the blood libel that Jews intentionally kill, fill in the blank, Muslims, children, Christians, children. And again, that's crazy stuff that's been disproven again and again, but under the guise of anti-Zionism, you can make ridiculous claims about Al-Shifa Hospital, the IDF in Oregon. So yes, Jonathan, this new conflict has all the old classic hallmarks of anti-Semitism. It's like, as they say, old wine in new bottles.
Right. Well, I mean, let me ask you this then. You know, we see quite a bit of anti-Semitic sentiment being voiced right now by Islamist groups, and not just Hamas, but other groups around the Middle East and beyond. Is Islamist anti-Semitism really distinct from these other forms or variants of anti-Semitism that we were just discussing?
I mean, I think these are all different hues of this, different hues of the same color. I mean, anti-Semitism, one of the unique aspects of it relative to other forms of prejudice is how it mutates across different cultures, across different epochs, across different political theories. So you'll see these myths about Jewish power in Islamist or faith-based anti-Semitism, or left-wing anti-Semitism, or extreme-right anti-Semitism. So it may be dressed up a little differently. But by the way, like I could show you extreme-right screeds that make wild claims about Zionist-occupied government. I could show you stuff from CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, that make claims today about Zionists owning government. I mean, again, it's just like these are sort of photo negatives of the same image.
Yeah. Yeah. It sort of seems like they're all merging onto the same highway right now. And it's getting messy. Yeah. Last question for you before we wrap up. I was reading a little bit about this new Atlas initiative of yours over there at ADL. Want to tell us just for a minute or two about what's going on there?
I mean, we're constantly thinking about how do we innovate? How do we find new ways to explain what we're doing or new approaches to solve this age old problem? So Atlas is this new tool we've developed. You can see it online at adl.org/Atlas. And it brings together sentiment analysis, incident data, policy reports on international dimensions of anti-Semitism. So it's sort of an interactive world map like Google Maps or Google Earth. You can click on a country, and let's say you click on, you know, France. You can see recent incident data drawn from our reports or from the reports of our partners in France. You could look at anti-Semitic attitudes drawn from our analyses or those of part organizations. Does the government have an anti-Semitism policy? What is it? Do they have a special coordinator, you know, or a special person working on the issues? It's a one-stop shop for all around the world to understand and integrate data and analysis around global dimensions of anti-Semitism.
Sounds like a useful tool, maybe a bit depressing at times, but that's the times we live in, right?
Yeah, look, if you're a scholar or a journalist or a student or just an interested person, you want to learn more, it's a great place. But these are signs of the time. Yeah. Like, we're dealing with an unprecedented surge and we've got to be responsive.
Well, I thank you for being responsive. I thank you for all that you do. And I thank you, Jonathan Greenblatt, for joining us today live on the FTD Morning Brief.
So awesome. Thanks to you and all my friends at FTD. Have a great day.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. FTD senior advisor Rich Goldberg has a scathing rebuke of the Biden administration for allowing that Chinese and Russian-backed UN resolution to go through. He says it's effectively calling for a Hamas victory at the UN Security Council. He breaks down all the flaws of the resolution and encourages Israel to move forward as it must, with or without international approval. It's a bold piece, to say the least. FTD senior advisor for energy, Brenda Schaefer, co-authored a new piece in Real Clear Energy, arguing that despite the impact it has on global oil prices, the West should permit and even encourage Ukraine's attacks on Russian oil refineries and tankers. Denying enemy energy resources has long been a bedrock of effective military strategy. Pain at the pump be damned. And finally, FTD's Peter Duran has a new piece out looking at the ways that Russian strongman Vladimir Putin has exploited and manufactured terrorism in the past to his own benefit. He warns that despite the world's natural compassion for those who were killed in Friday's ISIS attack in Russia, as a policy, the U.S. should resist the temptation to make common cause with Putinism against terrorism or anything else for that matter. All right, that's it. We're done for the day. Read our expert analysis on our website, FTD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FTD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at FTD.org/invest. Tune in Friday for another episode of the FTD Morning Brief featuring Jason Brodsky, policy director at United Against a Nuclear Iran, or UANI as they're known. They're a group dedicated to preventing Iran from getting the bomb. We'll talk to him about how that's going. So we'll see you Friday. Until then, I'm Jonathan Schanzer, signing off for FTD.